This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Just about an hour ago, the Federal Reserve announced another cut in the federal funds rate. Today's half-point reduction was a more significant cut than the quarter point most economists expected. Today's rate cut comes on the heels of a three-quarter-point cut last week. Previous concern about inflation rapidly gave way to fears of recession and hopes that the rate cuts can stave that off and steady the stock markets in the meantime. Amid all the turmoil, we figured you might have a question or two. How will this rate affect your credit, your mortgage, or the value of your home? What about the proposed economic stimulus? And have we reached the bottom? Are we close? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, Judea Pearl, the father of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was killed in Pakistan 6 years ago, on the Daniel Pearl standard of responsible journalism. But first, the economy. And we begin here in Studio 3A with Russell Roberts, an economics professor at George Mason University and a regular contributor to All Things Considered. Russell Roberts, nice to have you back on the program.
Good to be here.
This half-point cut is a surprise. It's pretty significant.
Well, you know, there's a big difference between a quarter and a half, and the difference is about a quarter. I don't think we know what the difference is. That's the strange thing about the state we're in right now. There's uncertainty about whether we're in a recession, not close to a recession, maybe one on the horizon. We have a stimulus package that was going to be quickly passed, now being loaded up with political goodies that may not pass at all. We have two very sizable rate cuts, as you point out, unexpectedly large. A lot of economic uncertainty that actually in and of itself is going to cause people making decisions to hesitate because they don't know how things are going to turn out. So I wish we as economists understood more about what we were doing, but we should frankly admit that we don't.
Well, last Monday, before the Fed announced that surprise rate cut Monday morning, it was Tuesday morning, Monday was the holiday.
Right.
But there were headlines in some of the papers about panic.
Yes.
And this has, at least in the short term, stabilized the markets. I think they're up 160 points, something like that today.
It appears that way. Of course, we don't know what markets would have done in the absence of that. It's always easy in these situations to explain things after the fact. It's kind of like the Super Bowl. Some people say the Giants are going to win. Some people think the Patriots. And they have an explanation for each of those possible theories. Now, after the fact, one of them will look very wise and one will look very foolish, but people continue to sell stories and narratives afterwards that that look wise. The unintelligent narratives get forgotten. So we're in a very similar situation. If it turns out on Friday, for example, there's a job report coming out for January. If it turns out that jobs surge, which there's some early indications that they will, people are going to say, oh, we were wrong. Maybe we're not on the cusp of a recession. If they're negative, if jobs actually fall or if unemployment claims change dramatically, again, I think people make a dramatic statement. But right now, I think we're really in the dark.
Well, you talk about these competing narratives. A month, 2 months ago, the narrative was, well, we got to worry about inflation.
Right. And I think we still do. I think this rate cut, if there's not a recession on the horizon, is going to look very painful in the next 3 to 6 to 12 months. But again, it's a political world we're in, especially in an election year, and short-run attention is always going to be paid at the cost of long-run attention.
What does an election year have to do with it?
They've got to look concerned. Politicians of all stripes are out there showing their concern that if the economy's not doing well, they're out there doing something about it, as if we knew how to steer a $14 trillion ship, which is, I think, a bit naive, but it sells. What politicians adapt is our attitudes toward the economy. Most of us, economists or not, have a sort of Keynesian idea that the economy is like a great engine, and if it's slowing down, we have to juice it up, stimulate it with either tax cuts of a strange form, just giving people money as opposed to changing their incentives, or changing monetary policy in a way that is going to somehow put more money in the system. If the economy is actually doing okay, you won't get much pain for making an error today because the costs are going to come later. So politicians are going to they're going to err on the side of caution. And those incentives are there and they're acting on them.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. We're talking about, all this mix of economic news and the questions that are in many people's minds. Russell Roberts is our guest, a professor of economics at George Mason University. 800-989-8255. If you'd like to join us, email is talk@npr.org. And Rex is with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Yes, I think we need some economic historians studying what the effect of the federal deficit has been historically on our economy. I'm not an economist. I'm a general contractor, but I've dealt in the real estate market long enough to realize that there's a definite connection between the large federal deficits and trade deficits and the instability in our economy. And whenever we've been able to keep the deficit under control and not out of whack, we have a stable economy. But I don't hear any economists pointing this relationship out. And I think if you study the history, you'll see that there is some relationship there.
Is this a deficit issue, do you think, Russ Roberts?
I don't think so, although I think the caller makes an excellent point about economic history. We've been running a merchandise trade deficit every year since about 1976, piling up trillions of dollars of deficits in the sense that each year we import more from abroad than we export. Most of the years since 1976 have been awfully good. We've had an incredible sustained run of economic success. So I don't think there's any real relationship between trade deficits and economic well-being. Budget deficits.
Federal deficits.
Well, federal budget deficits, most of the studies find a very limited effect on interest rates, and that's surprising. We borrow an enormous hundreds of billions of dollars every year. But the world capital market, which is where we borrow, is trillions of dollars. And so the impact on interest rates is relatively small. The real impact is to disguise to ourselves what the real costs of what we're doing are, and I think that has political consequences. But you raise...
Wait. In my college class, they specifically said that there's a competition for those dollars worldwide. If Uncle Sam is issuing treasury bills to pay his bills, he's competing with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and other investments.
And you and me.
Therefore, they have to charge...
The Bank of China.
...to entice those investors. So that's mathematically... And that's what irritates me about economists is they – I mean, I'm a businessman, and I see the math, and they don't.
Well, interest rates have been – when people look at the relationship, they find that, surprisingly, there isn't a very big relationship. And you're right. There should be. And the reason there isn't, I suspect, is that if you go out as an individual and you have been a renter and you decide to borrow money to buy a home, you don't drive up interest rates, even though there's more money being borrowed than before. And the reason is that you're a small part of a very large market. You have some kind of effect. It's just very, 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 very small. And it's surprising, but the U.S. government is a relatively small borrower at the current level. We could live in a world where that changes, obviously, if we continue to live beyond our means. But right now, it's surprising how small the impact on interest rates has been. But I do want to salute...
I'm not an economist, but I totally disagree.
Okay, Rex. Thanks very much for the call.
I do want to salute Rex's interest in economic history. It's important when we face these kind of issues of recession and monetary and fiscal policy that we remember that we've done these things in the past. And it's remarkably difficult to figure out whether they were actually successful or not. There's a general view that often it's too little too late, that the government responds either with fiscal or monetary policy after we're already in a recession, leading to effects such as inflation down the road. But it's very difficult to assess these, and as a result, we're sort of in a faith-based economics world where, unfortunately, in the world of macroeconomics, it's very difficult to discern and measure what works and what doesn't.
Well, let's transition for the moment from macroeconomics to real estate. Elizabeth Razzi, a real estate columnist for The Washington Post, with us from a studio at the paper's headquarters here in Washington, D.C. And Elizabeth Razzi, nice to speak with you again.
Oh, nice to talk with you, Neil.
So the 3/4 of a point last week, 0.5 point this week. Do interest rate cuts by the Fed then turn around and affect interest rates on people's mortgages?
On some loans, not on the typical 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, because those are actually influenced by the bond market. They track the 10-year bond, which is really how long a 30-year mortgage really lives. So bond markets, the folks on Wall Street and around the world who are bidding on those bonds will decide those interest rates. And if they get spooked about inflation, they could actually go up.
They could actually go up, even though the Fed interest rates are going down.
The Fed has very little control or influence over 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. They do have influence, and very direct influence, on some other mortgages that will put a lot of money into people's pockets.
Now, is there any sign that the housing market is on the mend?
Not a lot. But the thing to remember is this is a particularly slow time of the market every year. What's really going to be interesting is going to be to watch what happens this spring, starting February, late February, and see what kind of pent-up demand there might be. A lot of people have been sitting on the sidelines for maybe 2 years, buyers and sellers alike. And I'm getting even more questions from people about, is it time to buy? Is it time to get back in? What's going to happen? There's a lot of interest out there, and it'll be really interesting to see who comes back more, sellers or buyers.
Let's talk with Harold. Harold's on the line with us from Jacksonville in Florida.
Hello there. You may have actually answered my question quite a bit. I thought I had a question that might have been helpful for other listeners. I'm happy to say that I'll be closing on a house this Friday. And when I initiated the loan process, I went ahead and agreed at that time to a fixed rate. And I'm wondering, is this anything like the experience someone buys a car and then they drive past a car lot and find that the car that they just bought was a lot cheaper somewhere else?
What do you think, Elizabeth?
Well, are you saying you locked in your interest rate already?
Yes, I have.
Well, of course, you probably will be losing out a little bit, but maybe not. I mean, actually, 30-year fixed rate mortgages went up a little bit over the last week. They're quite low. What rate did you get?
I locked in 6%.
That's not so bad. You might be able to do better now, depending on, your overall indebtedness and the amount of down payment and that sort of thing that you have.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really something to lose sleep over.
Harold, first of all, congratulations. and not so bad. I'm sure you were hoping for something a little more rousing than that. Thanks.
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, that way it makes a lot of people who are waiting, I suppose, feel a little bit better about taking a step.
Yeah. Harold, thanks very much for the call. And Russell Roberts, in the 30 seconds we have left with you, housing, how much has that played a part in all this turmoil that we're talking about?
Well, there's some indication that the housing sector's troubles, which are also related to banking sector troubles, are geographically localized. The states that have a lot of subprime mortgage lending did struggle more recently. That'd be California, Florida, and Michigan. And there's hope that the rest of the economy is healthy. And if we should get things fixed up in housing, which will take their natural course, the economy will be all right.
Russell Roberts, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Russell Roberts, a professor of economics at George Mason University, with us here in Studio 3A. Elizabeth Rassi is going to stay with us to answer more of your questions about how this affects the real estate market. We're also going to be talking with Robert Shiller, the author of Irrational Exuberance, the man who seemed to have gotten it pretty well right, and talk about with him about whether he thinks it's hit the bottom. Stay with us. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow at this time, we'll hit the road and head for Baltimore. We're broadcasting from Morgan State University about race and economic mobility. And we'd like to hear your stories. What's the economic trajectory of your family? Will you do better than your parents? Will your children do better than you? Email us, talk@npr.org. Right now, we're talking about the economy for everybody. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates by another half point today, a cut that was in line with what Wall Street expected, maybe double what Wall Street expected. If you're feeling financial anxiety today, you're not alone. We're taking questions and answers about your economic fears, personal credit, housing, the markets. Let us know what's on your mind. Our guest is Elizabeth Rassi, real estate columnist for The Washington Post. And of course, if you'd like to ask her what your questions are, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Elizabeth, we have an email question from Marcus in Salt Lake City. One question I haven't seen raised locally or nationally, he writes, is what happens to those of us who aren't of the owning class in the midst of this housing crisis? I'm not sure if the trend is there nationwide, but here in Salt Lake City, a lot of rental properties, even previously low-rent apartments, are being listed as condos to be sold for a quick buck. My lease is nearly up in my current complex, and in my search for a new abode, three of the places I've had my eye on recently underwent this conversion. I'd stay where I am, but they will become condos in a few months' time as well. How do you see this affecting renters in the future?
Well, in most places, that's exactly the opposite of what's happening. Condos that developers were trying to sell were switched over into rentals, and that was suppressing the rent being charged to tenants to a point. That's not to say that rents have become real great bargains. And in your market, if that's what you're seeing, you only have two choices. You continue to rent or you try to buy. Make the decision about buying, though, not so much what happens to your rent next year, but what your plans are over the next 3 to 5 years, because you have to be prepared to hang on to it that long to make sure you don't lose money.
Well, joining us now is Robert Shiller, a professor of economics at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. He's with us from a studio there. And it's very good of you to join us again on this program.
My pleasure.
And you were the one who wrote about irrational exuberance in the housing market. You've proved to be right time and again. So do you think at this point, have we hit bottom?
I don't think so. The data that we at S&P, our Case-Shiller indexes, have been accelerating downward. In the latest data that we announced yesterday, our 10-city index went over the last year went down 8.4% on the year. And that's a record, and it's actually been accelerating for a couple of years now, the declines, or the rate of increase has been going down for a couple of years. So, no, I don't see in this, our latest report, any signs that we're hitting bottom.
So that means 6 months out, a year out?
Well, it's very hard to forecast. If you look at the last major cycle, that was in the early 1990s. Home prices were dropping rapidly until just about the end of the Gulf War in early 91. And then they seemed to stop that acceleration downward. And it seemed like, I think, the best story I can give is that our victory in that war somehow produced a sense of optimism suddenly. And then home prices just stagnated. They stopped falling. In the present situation, you know, I don't know that we have any good news suddenly coming. I don't know. Maybe if a new administration comes in, we'll find some inspiration in another 11 months. But I just don't see anything happening right now.
And the interest rate cuts by the Fed this week and last, what effect do you think they're going to have?
Well, I think Ben Bernanke, you know, he's an expert on the Great Depression and an expert on other times of great financial disorder. This is one of those times. We're seeing a lot of financial problems, and he wants to be aggressive in stimulating the economy. And these two moves together are quite aggressive measures. And I hope he's right. You know, this kind of thing is, unfortunately, it gets interpreted two different ways. One is, great, the interest rates are lower. But the other is, hey, the Fed must be worried. And so I kind of wonder what's going to happen to confidence as we move forward.
Well, particularly last week when the rate cut was announced, not on the normal run of meetings that was scheduled for this week and before the markets opened.
Yeah, that was quite an exciting day. Monday of last week, markets around the world seemed to be in a free fall. Of course, we were protected by Martin Luther King Day, so our markets weren't open. And that's when the Fed acted very, very decidedly. That was impressive. And it seemed to stabilize things. So for now, okay. But I still, you know, the big thing that worries me is that we've already lost about $1 trillion in home value in this country. And it's still going down. And, you know, the long-term implications of that for balance sheets of homes and business homeowners and businesses and so many people suggest that there's still a lot of action to come. Let's hope it's good.
Let's get another caller on the line. Gordon with us. Gordon from Nashville, Tennessee.
Yes, I was listening to the professor, and I couldn't agree more. My wife and I refinanced a couple of years ago, and we're probably atypical. We don't have our house mortgaged up to the hilt. We have several thousand dollars available to us in our second mortgage, and we got a note from Countrywide yesterday that they would be no longer honoring requests for second mortgage without a reappraisal. So I agree with the professor because I don't think the individual financial institutions have identified what each loan's potential risk is, and I think we are way far from the bottom.
And that suggests that, are you a subprime borrower?
No. We just happened to refinance a couple of years ago, and like I said, we have really never touched the line of credit available to us, but we now have to have our home reappraised if we want to do that. And, you know, I told my wife, I think they're trying to identify what each loan is actually worth because they're not sure what they've lost themselves.
Elizabeth Razzi, let me follow up with you on that. Is Gordon alone in this, or is this happening in a lot of places?
Well, for one thing, I don't think Gordon is as alone as he thinks he is in being a responsible borrower. There are a lot of people out there who have a lot of equity in their house who have been really responsible with their debts, and they've been sort of sitting on the sidelines. I think a really important thing once the markets, the financial markets recover so that credit-worthy people, especially those after jumbo mortgages, those are for more than $417,000, are able to get mortgages easily and at good rates, that will really free up a big logjam in the system. That part of the market is still afraid to lend money right now, and it's keeping people out of the home buying market.
Well, it's funny. I got another request in the mail today as a circumstance where it was just a mass mailer from Countrywide wanting to know if I wanted to refinance because the rates were falling. So I guess they're trying to generate income from that side of the equation now.
Yeah. And I was wondering, Robert Schiller, how long did it are we still – we're obviously still shaking out the subprime problems.
Very much so. You know, the president's proposal has not been enacted yet. And so even though Congress seems to be moving fast, it hasn't happened yet. You know, it is possible that these kinds of measures will work. In the Great Depression, I hate to bring that up, but home prices fell about 30% between 1925 and 1933. But then the Roosevelt administration created what was called the Home Owners Loan Corporation, which lent to homeowners who were in distress. That stopped it. Home prices stopped falling at that point. And so it is possible that this kind of these kind of measures, if we get going and we empower, you know, Fannie or Freddie to make loans or FHA on a larger scale or for bigger mortgages, it is possible that that could change the mood of the market.
Mm. Well, and while everyone's waiting for Congress and the administration to pass the stimulus program, the refinancings that have been – there's been a rush of refinancings of, among creditworthy borrowers over the last 2 months or so as interest rates have come down. And that's putting real dollars into people's budgets immediately. Mm. And that will continue month after month. If you take a $200,000 mortgage, which is not untypical – and go refinance them from 6.25% to the current rate of about 5.5% for a creditworthy borrower, you can save up, you know, almost $100 a month. I mean, $95 each month through the year, that's a lot of money that's spendable.
Here's an email question on this same point from David in Fox Lake, Wisconsin. Why do pundits keep asking if the subprime crisis is over when the vast majority of subprime loans haven't even begun to reset? Robert Schiller, what does he mean by reset, and is he right?
Well, a reset refers to the original plan. When you get an adjustable rate mortgage, the contract has certain dates when the rates can be adjusted based on the level of interest rates. And some of these were 2 years or some 3 years. A lot of them are coming into that period now, this year, and some of them next year. And so this has been a big worry because interest rates had gone up a lot. Now they're coming back down. So the problem is that subprimes are in a higher level of default now. And the prospect, it's not just incidentally due to the rates coming down or the rates having gone up. Because we'll correct that with the rate cuts, but it's also that home prices have gone down. So a lot of people don't feel the same incentive to continue paying on their mortgage when the home price is down because they may be underwater. Some of them, most of them are not, but there are some who their mortgage exceeds the value of their house now. And historically, that has been a big predictor of defaults. It's when people see that they're underwater that the mortgage market, the housing market is declining, that they start to default in great numbers. So even though interest rates are coming down, unless it perks up the market, we can't be sure that it's going to solve the problem.
Thanks very much for the call, Gordon. Let's see if we can get Nicole on the line. Nicole is calling us from Kalamazoo in Michigan.
Hi, I'm on the road, so I don't know if I'll lose you with my cell phone. If I do, I'll just listen to your answer. I just have a quick question for Elizabeth about 15-year fixed-rate mortgages versus 10-year fixed-rate mortgages versus 30. Is there a reason why one should do a 30-year fixed mortgage over a 15-year fixed mortgage if one has the in their budget a monthly the monthly payments enough to pay for a 15-year mortgage in terms of investing that money in something else? And I'll just listen to your question.
Okay.
That's really good thinking. One of the very best reasons, though, to go for a 15, and it's not necessarily the right decision for everybody, but what goes in favor of it is that you do get a break on the rate. It's about a half of a point right now. The other reason you might consider it is if your retirement day is within 15 or 20 years, you may not want to stretch out your mortgage indebtedness another 30 years starting the clock right now. On the other hand, if you want more flexibility in your monthly budget, you can still take out the 30-year mortgage or even a 20-year term and prepay the principal, especially in the early years of the loan, and retire that early. The advantage that gives you is if times get tough, you can revert just to the regular amount that's owed on the 30-year schedule. And so you basically can give yourself a free loan anytime you need it.
Hmm. Nicole, thanks very much and good luck. Well, obviously her cell phone did have a problem with it. We're talking with Elizabeth Razzi, the real estate columnist at The Washington Post, and with author of Irrational Exuberance, Robert Shiller, the Stanley Rezor Professor of Economics at Yale University. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get James on the line. James with us from Toledo, Ohio.
Yeah, I just wanted to express a bit of frustration about the misinformation about the Fed rate cuts actually having a bearing on mortgage interest rates. I just find it interesting. Basically, the fact of the matter is that 30-year mortgage interest rates are based off the bond market, not what the Fed funds rate is doing.
As Elizabeth Razzi explained to us earlier, yes.
Right. It's just that, you know, when the guy called in earlier, she said, well, you might be able to get a lower rate this week. And a lot of people have that misconception. But really, if you want to know, you just look at the bond market and what that's doing. And usually the bond market has usually priced that rate cut in long before the Fed actually has a chance to act on it. And that's all I had to say.
Okay.
I actually said that because rates may have come down. He may have locked in several weeks ago if he's just about to close. And so the prevailing interest rate right now is a little bit less than that. So if he were locking in today, he might be getting a better deal. But I don't think it's enough to stay up awake all night. The thing that is affected by the Fed rate cut, though, is home equity lines of credit, and especially for people who use those home equity loans for piggyback mortgages, you know, instead of part of their down payment. Those are usually tied to the prime rate, and that is going to definitely be affected by the Fed interest rate cuts. And so that's another source of easing in the family budget.
Let's get Tony on the line. Tony with us from St. Louis.
Good day. Professor Shiller, please compare the commercial real estate bubble of the mid-80s to the housing bubble today. It seems that the Republicans learned to use markets to absorb the inflationary effects of the national debt, which crossed $1 trillion in 1981, and the Dow crossed 1,000 in 1981. And the 1986 Tax Act apparently was because the commercial real estate was at least 20% overbuilt in all the large cities.
Well, let's give Professor Shiller a chance to respond.
You're bringing in a long sweep of history here. We did have a commercial real estate boom in the 80s, and the 86 Tax Act changed the incentives to invest in commercial real estate, and that's all long ago. I don't think we have any event like that happening right now. The thing that I see right now is that the commercial real estate apartment buildings, that's an apartment component of commercial real estate, has been booming also. And that's because it kind of substitutes for residential real estate. Home prices and apartment prices tend to move together. And so we've seen a boom in both of these. It's interesting that it goes beyond commercial buildings as well. We've seen land prices going up. We've seen art prices going up. There's been a general optimistic in stock prices, as you know, until just recently. And so I think it represents a sort of boom psychology, maybe other factors as well, that has infected a lot of markets.
Thanks for the call, Tony.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And before I say thank you to our guests, I should quote this last email. I'm not sure who it's from, but the remark is, things that go up go down, but things that go down go up. Simple. So I guess we can all just hang tight and just wait it all out. Robert Shiller, thanks so much for your time today.
Okay, my pleasure.
Robert Shiller's book, Irrational Exuberance, and he's a professor of economics at Yale University. He joined us from a studio on the Yale campus. Elizabeth Razzi is the real estate columnist for The Washington Post and joined us from a studio at The Washington Post today. And thank you for your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
Coming up, 6 years ago this week, journalist Daniel Pearl was murdered in Pakistan. We'll talk with his father, Judea Pearl, about the meaning of his death and the media's part in it, and what the media can do about it, and what you can do about it as a media consumer. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.